Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today on the show, we will have a feature on clean coal.
Clean coal will power this future.
A story about how national tax reform will impact energy out west, looking at coal, oil, and gas, and renewables as well.
The conferees really saved us from the direct assaults. All of the House provisions that would have undermined renewable energy credits were rejected.
Members of a Native American tribe go on their first buffalo hunt.
We try to preserve what things we can that's valuable amongst our culture.
And we'll discuss sexual violence prevention and find out what Wyoming's congressional delegation hopes to accomplish in 2018. This is all coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. The debate over tax reform has finally come to an end. Congress has passed its bill, and President Trump has signed it. But what's it all mean for Western energy? Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim helps deconstruct tax reform's impact.
Greg Whetstone did not expect tax reform to take aim at renewable energy development. He's the CEO and president of the American Council on Renewable Energy. He said earlier this year his organization spoke with key members of the House who seemed assured renewables would not be touched.
The reality was very different.
The first versions of both the House and Senate bills threatened a primary incentive to wind development, the production tax credit. Wyoming, Montana, and Colorado are just a few western states enjoying new wind developments, thanks in part to those credits, to the tune of some $3 billion each from utilities like Xcel Energy and Rocky Mountain Power. Thousands of new megawatts are expected to be added to the Western grid by 2020. So, as Congress entered conference to pull together the two bills, there was considerable pushback from the renewable industry.
The conferees really saved us from the direct assaults. All of the House provisions that would have undermined renewable energy credits were rejected. Those provisions would have had a devastating and immediate impact on the sector.
The wind production tax credits retained in the tax bill will generate some $85 billion in economic activity between now and 2020 when they're phased out. That's according to the American Wind Energy Association.
The only remaining problem was in this new so-called BEAT tax.
That was the other surprise threat that showed up in the first Senate version. The Base Erosion Anti-Abuse Tax Provision, or BEAT, was intended to stop multinational companies from sidestepping tax liability overseas. That had the unfortunate side effect of also impacting renewable tax credits. A report from a Bloomberg analytic firm estimated $12 billion of annual renewable investment was at stake. It's a problem because renewable tax credits are typically sold off to investors as a way to raise funds for new developments, which are very capital-intensive up front.
This is big capital investment. It's like building a power plant and buying 25 years of fuel all at once.
Whetstone says in the original Senate bill, the credits would have been taxed at an 100% rate. But in the final version, wind and solar companies can offset that tax by 80%. While it's a big improvement, to Whetstone, it's still not enough.
Raising capital to build these projects is going to be a little harder. It's going to be a little more expensive. And maybe more than a little. That's what we don't know.
So while renewables come out not too badly bruised, fossil fuel industries came out the biggest energy winner. Kathleen Scama is president of the Western Energy Alliance. She says the reduction in the corporate tax from 35% to 21% is a great boost.
When you reduce tax rates, industries can create more jobs, create more economic activity, because instead of paying more in taxes, they have more capital that they can invest and create jobs and economic growth.
The tax reduction will save oil and gas firms billions, not to mention add $1 billion to profits. That's according to the Washington Post, referencing a Barclays report. In the West, energy development is largely comprised of small and independent companies. They'll see benefits in a simplified tax code.
It's not about the past of handing things out to various industries. It's about a fair, straight across the board rate for all industries, treating all small businesses the same.
Coal is a different story. Large coal companies like Arch and Peabody, both of which operate in the western U.S., are just emerging from bankruptcies. The companies are still offsetting their profits against years of losses. With the corporate tax reduction, paying back losses will actually take longer. While the president has now signed a tax reform bill, that doesn't mean the conversation is over. There's a new bill that addresses a whole list of tax breaks, many of which have already expired. That list includes renewable energy. While Congress seems unsure of when to debate the issue, it could come back up in 2018. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Last year was a whirlwind for lawmakers in Washington, but gridlock reigned supreme and much of the GOP agenda was blocked. Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo caught up with Wyoming's lawmakers about what they're hoping to accomplish in 2018.
President Donald Trump told voters he would come to Washington and shake things up, which he surely has, but not in the way many people expected. He spent much of last year frustrated that he couldn't get much of his agenda through Congress. But he did have success unwinding regulations, especially many on the oil and gas industry. While riding the subway underneath the Capitol, Wyoming Senator John Barrasso explains that in the new year, he's hoping to revive a bipartisan energy bill that lawmakers have failed to get both chambers to agree on.
Energy is always a big priority for me, and we do have a good bipartisan bill with lots of support. We need to get it combined with the House, but I'd like to work on that.
Barrasso says Trump has been great for energy, and Congress now has a role to play in helping him expand U.S. exports.
We know there is a demand because we know that Vladimir Putin uses energy as a weapon. President Trump talks about energy dominance for America, no longer just energy security or energy independence, but actual energy dominance, and I want to be part of that.
For Barrasso, energy legislation also means infrastructure, because increased drilling is meaningless unless you can get the oil and gas to the markets.
And additionally, there's infrastructure issues that we need in terms of roads, bridges, the issues of ports as well. But from a Wyoming standpoint, infrastructure is a big part of this.
But Democrats say the GOP has moved so far to the right that it's hard to negotiate with them. Pennsylvania Democratic Senator Bob Casey says that's why Democrats were able to win an Alabama Senate seat for the first time in 25 years. He says the politics from races like that are having an impact on policymaking in Washington.
I think they've allowed their extremes to kind of drive the bus every day. And that's one of the reasons they had trouble in Alabama. I mean, you saw the extremes getting not just support, but being nominated. But I think it's also hurt on policy.
Despite this, Casey and other Democrats say they're willing to negotiate and pass bills in 2018 with a GOP majority, but only if Republican leaders give them a seat at the table.
Oh, sure. I think certainly on infrastructure, which is what we should have started 2017 with. I think even the president would admit that. But I hope that's still an area of focus for Republicans.
Wyoming Senior Senator Mike Enzi is eyeing one area that may bring the two parties together: budget reforms. He's the chair of the Budget Committee and is hoping to convince his fellow lawmakers to move from funding the government annually to doing a biennial budget like they do in Wyoming. Enzi also says he's been busy crafting his committee's budget in advance of the release of President Trump's, which is new.
He or she, as the case might be in the future, always have the right to give us suggestions. That's what the president does. But we're in charge of the purse. And so I want to reform budget so that it plays a more responsible role. A budget that's passed around here lasts about 40 days before they start waiving the provisions in it.
After the Senate failed to repeal Obamacare, bipartisan talks have intensified to fix some of the problems with the current health system. Enzi is hoping lawmakers in both parties will work together this year to strengthen small business health plans and to boost health savings accounts, among other items.
One of the things that happened with the health care debate that we had is when it started out, the Democrats said, we don't need any changes, we just need more time and it'll be fine. By the end of the debate, the Democrats were saying, you know, if you just slow this process down and work with us, we'll do some bipartisan changes and we'll fix it. Well, that's where we really need to be, and that's what we've been working on.
Over in the House, Republicans remain frustrated with the slow pace of the Senate, and because Senate Republicans failed to overhaul Obamacare. Congresswoman Liz Cheney says she'd rather Senate Republicans scrap the Affordable Care Act than fix it with their Democratic counterparts.
Look, I think it is going to be crucial for the Senate to deal with several things. One of them is Obamacare, obviously. I think people back home are just facing skyrocketing premiums, and people are going to go bankrupt. They're going to go without insurance.
Cheney says her party's future depends on what lawmakers in Congress do this year.
whether we are successful in keeping our majority next year will depend in large part on what we get done. And so we're going to have to continue to make sure we get things done. And I think it'll, you know, hopefully it'll inspire people, you know, to be even more constructive and really begin moving. Because I do think that, you know, our majority will depend upon whether we can get stuff done.
2018 is an election year. That often means more gridlock than usual. Optimists in Washington hope it will drive both sides to the middle so they have something to brag about on the campaign trail. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Coming up, we go on a bison hunt and talk about sexual violence prevention. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Most states have laws or pending legislation requiring that public schools teach sexual violence prevention. That leaves Wyoming as one of the few states with absolutely nothing on the books. But the Wyoming Sexual Violence Prevention Council is working to fill this gap by supporting a growing network of local projects. Among them is a program that works with student-athletes. Wyoming Public Radio's education reporter Tennessee Watson interviewed Bob Vines, the Washakie County Victim Witness Coordinator, to find out more.
I deliver direct services to victims of crime. I work with a lot of children, a lot of victims of sexual abuse and domestic violence. I also work with the Coalition Against Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault with some of their primary prevention programs that deal with youth.
And you're focusing some of those prevention efforts on student athletes. Can you describe those programs?
We've got a couple programs. One is called Coaching Boys into Men. It utilizes coaches in their mentoring role to discuss healthy relationships with their teams. And that one's directed towards boys athletic teams. Not necessarily that athletes have a higher propensity for abuse, but they're also, especially in small communities like we have in Wyoming, they're also the school leaders. There's nothing like a Friday night in some of our small towns at the football field. We gather around these kids, we put them on pedestals, we praise them, we put their images all over our local newspapers. There are leaders, and there are leaders in our school. When they speak up, then they're sending a message to other students that they can speak up as well, too. And that's where we really start seeing culture change when it comes to gender-based violence.
And are you also working with young women that are athletes?
Yeah, the female program is called Athletes as Leaders. It was just developed in Seattle, and we had a couple pilot communities in Wyoming that tested it out. Utilizes a lot of media. They'll show a clip to the girls, and it'll begin a conversation. Anything from girl positivity, body image standards, rumor spreading, whereas young boys have different topics that they're discussing, such as bragging about sexual reputation, when aggression crosses the line, there's no excuse for relationship abuse, and basically respectful behavior towards women and girls in their lives. We find that the first couple sessions, the boys are a little bit tentative, but then they begin quickly to direct the conversation.
And it seems like education efforts like this could bring some hard stuff to the surface mm-hmm. for the students. So how are coaches prepared to respond?
If an athlete does bring a situation to a coach, schools have policies, and the coaches are well aware of when they need to report as required by law. However, we make sure that the coaches are armed with a whole list of resources, including local violence prevention advocates like myself. When a coach feels the need to bring somebody else in, or even if they're uncomfortable talking about a topic such as consent, there are experts in every community in Wyoming that would just love an opportunity to assist coaches in those difficult discussions. Kids want to talk about this. Coaches feel a little bit nervous, but when they start getting going on it, they start understanding, I guess, the importance of the topics and become more engaged. And the more engaged the coach is, the more engaged the athletes are. And there's some really great conversations that are being had in locker rooms all across the state.
How are you going to know that you're having an impact? Is there a certain data set or a certain statistic that you're trying to influence?
obviously the statistics that will ultimately show whether we are improving is whether or not sexual misconduct decreases, whether it's misdemeanor sexual battery or more felonious things. What we see, especially coming through courts, is confusion in young people. Confusion about what is legal and what isn't legal, or their concepts of what is appropriate, or even their concept of consent. We want to protect young women from these acts, but also we want to protect young men too. So we need to make sure that our young men understand what is required of them, as well as protecting young women. 90% of all sexual assaults are committed by somebody that the victim knew and trusted. And those are the situations that we need to prepare our kids for. If 1 in 5 young women are going to be sexually assaulted by the time that they are through college, then what tools are we giving our young women and young men prior to sending them off to college? Our whole idea is to teach young men to be respectful and caring and not hurt. While at the same time, we want to teach young girls that self-confidence in order to identify when they're in an uncomfortable situation and those tools that they may need to get themselves out of that uncomfortable situation. So we're coming at it two different angles with young people.
When you look around at who's doing sexual violence prevention work in Wyoming, are you one of the only men?
I do mention that I'm getting used to being the only man in the room at a lot of these trainings and stuff, which is a little bit frustrating. I know that a majority of men are not abusers. A majority of men believe that the work we do is very, very important, but we haven't done a very good job of engaging them. And that's what this movement needs, is more men engaged. We really just want men to speak up when they identify disrespectful behavior. And it's not that hard to do. There's that little voice inside your head that sometimes when you're a group of men where the conversation starts getting uncomfortable and that little voice says, I don't feel right about this. But you're also thinking, well, nobody else is saying anything, so maybe I'm the only one that has an issue with it. Well, that's generally not the case. More than likely, there's other people in that group that are thinking the exact same thing, and we just need somebody to speak up. That invokes culture change. That changes the way that you raise children. That means children will grow up differently and they will raise their children differently. And that's how we change culture.
That was Tennessee Watson speaking with Bob Vines. He'll be hosting a sexual violence prevention training for educators and coaches in Casper on January 16th. For information about how to register, go to wyomingpublicmedia.org. Starting in 2006, the state of Montana granted permission to a couple of tribes to hunt on federal public lands near Yellowstone National Park. That was due to a treaty that was agreed upon in 1855 that includes tribes from the Pacific Northwest. The Yakima Nation is the first tribe from Washington State to join in on the hunt. Those tribal members drew tags and recently traveled to Yellowstone to exercise their right to hunt buffalo on public land for the first time. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kadelska joined in.
It's a cold, gray December morning. Chris Johnson and Hunter Old Elk drive slowly along a snow-covered path looking for Rainbow Point Road.
It's 4.5, so we just passed mile marker 3.
Okay.
That's Rainbow Point. That's where we want to go. Okay, we gotta turn around.
Johnson, Old Elk, and another family member, Jeffrey Sampson, are part of a group taking their first attempt at hunting for buffalo. Sampson drew a tag from the Yakima Nation pool to hunt back in November. He has 31 days to use the tag, and he's excited.
And I just felt it was a big interest to be part of that and preserve this right for future generations as they came forward.
When the United States marshaled tribes onto reservations, treaties were drawn between the sovereign nations. During the 1850s, a handful of tribes in the Washington Territory signed a general template known as Stevens Treaty that included the right for the tribe to hunt and fish on federal public lands, such as Forest Service and Bureau of Land Management lands. Today, buffalo don't roam the plateau in Washington State, which is why Old Elk and Johnson are driving around Yellowstone, scouting for buffalo that they hope to hunt outside the park. Johnson says buffalo tracks are usually easy to spot.
One thing about buffalo is
if you watch in the snow, their legs aren't long. So when they leave, they'll spread the snow, and you know it's a buffalo because the snow will be spread out.
Suddenly, Old Elk stops the car. She peers out behind her at the snow-covered roadside, and they get out.
Those are tracks line, but there's a, see the feet? Those are just footprints, hoofs. No, a buffalo is going to be this, and he's going to have snow pushed, and the spread will all be pushed out because he's pushing snow out in front of him.
As Johnson and Old Elk turn back around at the end of the road, they pass a man on a snowmobile.
Oh, did you see that? You.
Is that really? What he said?
Yeah. Well, that's what he mouthed it pretty clear.
The controversy is hard to ignore. Although it is within the tribe's right to hunt buffalo, not everyone agrees that hunting is the best way to manage the buffalo herds. Supporters believe it is an effective way to control their population and the diseases they carry. But opponents such as the Buffalo Field Campaign argue there are still not enough buffalo. Mike Mies of the campaign says buffalo need to be able to roam free.
It's not about the buffalo's future. It's about making sure the buffalo have no future other than their reservation known as Yellowstone.
Buffalo wander out of the park during harsh winters in search of food. Due to the lack of snow this year, the buffalo weren't pushed out of the park, keeping them from being hunted by the group. But the trip was more than just getting a buffalo. Samson says it was about the Yakima Nation's ability to exercise their treaty rights and preserve the culture of hunting and gathering.
We're a dying generation, and we try to preserve what things we can that's valuable amongst our culture. And this is one of the things I think my children sure value it.
The Yakima Tribal Council extended Samson's tag for another couple of weeks, but he doesn't think he'll find the time or money to go out to West Yellowstone again. Maybe next year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Godelska from the Center of the West in Cody.
Up next is a mini documentary on clean coal. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. President Donald Trump has used the term clean coal a lot lately, often when talking about bringing back the coal industry.
There is a thing called clean coal.
Clean coal, right?
Clean
We've
coal.
We've ended the war on beautiful, clean coal.
And we're going to have clean coal. It's clean coal.
Clean coal.
American clean coal will power this future.
But what does he actually mean when he says clean coal? In truth, it can mean a lot of different things. When many people talk about clean coal, they're talking about cleaning up carbon dioxide out of coal emissions. In Wyoming, where the majority of this country's coal is still mined, clean coal is looked at as a possible economic savior. Without it, the industry faces a long, slow decline. It's a big deal for a lot of other people, too. 40% of the world still depends on coal for electricity, and it's still one of the cheapest and most abundant fuels. And CO2 from coal and other fossil fuels is causing global warming. So it would be nice if, you know, we didn't produce CO2 from burning coal. In some places, that really depends on the coal. This concept of clean coal is really looked at as a holy grail. To help explain how is Inside Energy's Madeline Beck.
The whole concept of clean coal is wonky. Real technical, real complicated, not this simple at all.
Clean coal, meaning they're taking out coal, they're going to clean it.
My first outline for this story was like a master's thesis on the subject. Long and dull. But here's the thing. From my reporting, I've found many people on both sides of the aisle think that this could be a world-changing technology. That it could be one of the only ways to keep climate change from warming the Earth more than 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels. That's when some believe we will reach a tipping point and we'll be headed for uncontrollable warming. Yeah, kinda crazy. And that sound? Icebergs calving into the ocean. So early on, I freaked out a bit about how to get this idea across to regular people who care about their world but don't care much about coal. So I called my best friend Dylan. He's a 25-year-old artist working graveyard shifts at a grocery store.
Okay, so if I'm doing a podcast about clean coal, what would you want to know about clean coal?
I don't know. Like, when it comes, I don't have many thoughts on coal, Madeline.
But he's the type of person I want to listen to this. Someone who doesn't think about coal. I needed to know if there was any coal-related thing he cared about. So I nudged him.
I guess, like, with coal in general, why do we need to keep it, and why is it such a controversy, and why does it just, why does it get eliminated? Or what makes the coal clean? How do you clean coal?
So I'm breaking it down so folks like Dylan are interested. Because this clean coal project, it's something that's simmering under the surface right now, but could be a worldwide discussion going forward. I mean, for some, like David Earnshaw, it means everything.
Well, I'm 86 years old now, so I don't have an awful lot of years left, and I want to try to use them to the best advantage to try to keep doing this, because I think it's, for me, it's the most important project or most important subject in the world.
So the guy you just heard, David Earnshaw, remember him. You'll hear more from him later. But first, we're going to go back to where clean coal is from, where it already overcame a lot of struggles. Struggles like acid rain. It goes back to the 80s, and since then, permeated the culture.
Good Lord, acid rain!
I'm singing in the rain. I'm just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling! Ah! It burns like a Glasgow bikini wax! Gah!
As you heard, it even made it into The Simpsons. Granted, you couldn't actually feel it burning your skin, but people were legitimately afraid that Washington, D.C.'s limestone buildings were going to crumble and ecosystems would die out. Here's a CBS News clip from 1983.
The water in acid rain carries poisons like sulfuric acid. That acid and its effects have been blamed for killing fish and plant life in hundreds of lakes in the northeastern United States and Canada.
You see, coal emissions were a major contributor to acid rain, so Congress came up with the term clean coal as something to shoot for. Less sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides coming from coal emissions, so those didn't get into the air we breathe. And in 1980, we couldn't abandon the coal because half of the nation's energy still came from the black carbon. But it needed to be cleaned up. So here's step number one in the climb to clean coal. There was a known technology to clean up emissions called scrubbers. Real original name. Scrubbers use a combination of water droplets and limestone to essentially pull sulfur dioxide out of coal emissions after the coal is burned. But they weren't adopted immediately. Meet John Thompson.
Well, I was a student at the University of Illinois getting my chemical engineering degree in the late 1970s, early 80s.
He was part of an effort at the university to get those scrubbers up and running.
And the governor of the state of Illinois was proposing to convert our campus power plant from burning natural gas to high sulfur Illinois coal. And he wasn't going to put scrubbers on it.
Along with a group of faculty and other students, Thompson convinced Governor James Thompson, no relation, that his new coal plant, it had to have scrubbers.
And so he helicoptered onto the campus in 1982, announced scrubbers on the plant, and that there would be others following. And it became a national demonstration effort for the role of sulfur dioxide scrubbers on coal.
And these scrubbers really did clean the coal, or at least its sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxides emissions. But it was a regulation, not a new technology, that finally got the coal industry to clean up its SO2 problem. In 1990, Congress strengthened the Clean Air Act, limiting sulfur emissions to about half what they were in 1980, and scrubbers were the best, cheapest way to clean those emissions. And also, as a result, power plants started looking for coal with less sulfur naturally. And they found it by moving their coal supply chain from Appalachia to Wyoming. And these early clean coal efforts worked. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency found that between 1990 and 2010, sulfur dioxide emissions dropped 51%, even as coal use grew. Now, the quest for clean coal gets more difficult. We just talked about cleaning up sulfur emissions, but that's not all that people are concerned about when it comes to coal. Basically, scrubbers scrub a lot of gunk out of coal emissions, but not carbon dioxide. To get that out, plants need a much more complex process to not only remove the carbon, but sequester it for either storage or transport. And while we know how to capture CO2, it takes a ton of energy to remove it from coal emissions. So instead of raining down as acid rain, those carbon emissions stay up in the atmosphere for a while to help insulate us in a warm, fuzzy carbon blanket, leading to global warming, climate change. It's true that other energy sources do this too, but coal is the heaviest emitter. Natural gas, its runner-up, emits only about half the carbon emissions. With that in mind, there's a lot of people out there that just want to stop using coal altogether.
Clean coal is, we argue about this, so it's just a misnomer.
If you didn't just have a junior high science class flashback, that's Bill Nye, the science guy. He's talking on MSNBC.
You're making carbon dioxide, which is causing the world to warm faster than it ever has warmed in history. And this will have tremendous consequences for everyone in the world. Clean coal is a myth.
And Bill Nye isn't alone. The Sierra Club has a Beyond Coal campaign, and it isn't backing down.
My name is Connie Wilbert. I am the director of the Sierra Club here in Wyoming, the Wyoming chapter.
She's from Wyoming, a state that depends on coal for its economy and is the number one coal-producing state in the nation. But she sticks by the Sierra Club's stance on clean coal tech.
It's still basically expensive, unproven potential technology, and it's just not a good use of our money or resources right now. We think that there are other much more viable, truly clean energy sources like wind and solar that are ready to go.
Ready to go, but not ready to completely overtake coal in the next few years. The U.S. is using less coal, largely because of low natural gas prices. In the last 5 years, from 2011 to 2016, U.S. coal production dropped 33%. But as of July 2017, there were nearly 700 large plants still operating in the nation. So it'll take decades to phase it out entirely if that happens. As of July, there were 530 coal plants under construction around the world, with several hundred more in the wings. So other environmental groups, like the Natural Resources Defense Council and Clean Air Task Force, they think, realistically, coal is going to continue to be burnt for a long time. And in this instance, they're standing alongside groups in the fossil fuel industries and in the U.S. government by promoting something called carbon capture. So if some environmental groups are even on board for carbon capture, what's their argument? Well, Thompson can tell you. Remember him? He's the guy who helped get scrubbers on smokestacks in Illinois. Now he works for the Clean Air Task Force, a nonprofit that aims to mitigate the effects of climate change. There, he's pushing to clean up carbon from coal emissions. But he's not just focusing on coal.
It certainly has its place on coal. But it also works on new gas plants. It works on industrial facilities, too.
See, as of 2010, more than a fifth of the worldwide carbon emissions were from other industries like cement and steelmaking. But right now, coal is a main focus because it's such a big CO2 emitter. And in Wyoming, there's a big old project costing more than $20 million going up on the backside of a coal plant. The coal plant is called the Dry Fork Station. It's huge, with a smokestack reaching up about 500 feet. If you go around back, jutting off a huge pipe-looking structure, there's a metal box on scaffolding. It's pretty dinky in comparison to the rest of the plant, but both it and a few new gravel pads beyond it symbolize one of Wyoming's biggest bets for clean coal.
I use the word, and I don't use it terribly lightly, but this is kind of the holy grail of coal.
That's Kurt Pearson. He's a spokesman for Basin Electric, which is an energy cooperative that owns the power plant. He took me around to look at how this metal box is connected with the larger multi-million dollar project known as the Integrated Test Center. The coal emissions from the power plant will be funneled down through piping underground to gravel pads. Researchers are going to set up their own trailers or pop-up buildings on these gravel pads, using the freshly produced emissions to find the best way to capture carbon and turn it into a marketable product. Jason Bager is the head guy overseeing the test center. He's the executive director of the Wyoming Infrastructure Authority, and I talked with him back in his office in Cheyenne about what this means for the state.
When you look at like what's happening now with like school construction funding and university funding, I mean, pick your funding issue, you know, over the last couple of years, things have changed.
He's talking about struggles that the oil, gas, and coal industries have seen over the past few years. Wyoming's school capital construction costs, which were about $100 million a year, were almost completely funded by coal leases. And now there are no new leases. And this coal slump is hurting a lot of other areas, too. This very red state even considered an income tax. It's one of seven states without one. But Bager says coal is about more than keeping taxes low. It's about coal town communities and jobs, a way of life that could be lost.
There's one thing that, you know, you can kind of look at it and get sort of, depressed or down that, like, okay, things are changing. But also, that's when opportunity exists.
Opportunities like carbon capture technology could bring people together.
You know, climate change itself. I mean, that whole conversation, it has almost become religious in a sense, you know, on both sides, not pointing fingers. And so it's like, you guys are kicking around a political football. Let's just really focus on the technology engineering sort of things and depoliticize this.
It could be a win for climate change activists and the coal industry. If a coal plant can capture CO2 and turn it into something that people want, it could sell that product. Then it could recoup the cost of capturing carbon and maybe even make money, while, you know, keeping emissions out of the atmosphere. And it really doesn't matter what the product is, as long as it makes money. They're messing with cement, protein powder, shoes, all kinds of stuff. And most of it's doable. It's just the money factor. We've known how to capture carbon for decades, but it just costs too much and takes too much energy for any plant to actually want to do it, or even be able to do it without losing a ton of money. Take one high-profile example, the Kemper County Energy Facility in Mississippi. It was supposed to cost less than $3 billion and finish up in 2014. Costs skyrocketed, and 3 years after the expected finish, the price tag was at $7.5 billion. Developers gave up, and now the facility will only burn gas. So, at this Wyoming test center, they're hoping to turn the clean coal story from a costly failure to that win-win scenario.
Well, from the engineering perspective, the carbon dioxide going up the stack is nothing more, nothing less than a waste product.
That's Dennis Thorfinson, head engineer at the Dry Fork Coal Plant, who's also overseeing the construction of the Integrated Test Center. I met him near there at the Arbuckle Lodge, a hotel in Gillette, Wyoming. He has a full blonde mustache and large glasses. He's skeptical of things he can't prove, but sticks by what he can. He says it doesn't matter if people buy into human-caused climate change or not.
If we can do something with the carbon dioxide and make it profitable, well then everybody wins.
And there's a few other types of clean coal to recognize too. Wyomingites are working to store it underground permanently, something called carbon sequestration, and they're also injecting CO2 into old oil fields. That's called enhanced oil recovery. Thompson from the Clean Air Task Force says it's a big draw in a state that also depends on oil and gas for revenue.
it produces more oil, and it also at the same time traps the CO2 and locks it into that those oil formations so that it doesn't reach the atmosphere.
And then there's another type of carbon capture that Thompson and others think has a lot of promise, the alum cycle, using carbon emissions to make energy, with carbon dioxide turning turbines. Bill Brown is the CEO of Net Power, a company working on this process. He spoke at a press conference in North Dakota about the alum cycle. At that presser, a reporter brings up the failed Kemper facility in Mississippi. He says,
there are a lot of lessons learned. First of all, I don't blame Kemper at all. I think that Kemper is the brick phone. Remember brick phones? They were the size of bricks, and you held them to your face, and you talked on them. Well, today, we have these.
He holds up a smartphone.
We're the this version of carbon capture.
He says it was the initial movement that started the ball rolling.
And so it takes people building something, going through the expense, and helping us figure out how to miniaturize it, how to make it more economical. And that's what we're doing.
And then there are the dreamers.
I'm 86 years old now, so I don't have an awful lot of years left, and I want to try to use them to the best advantage to try to keep doing this.
That's David Earnshaw, the guy you heard at the very beginning of this podcast. He's one of two men in their 80s who think that their solution is the best clean coal out there because it doesn't involve burning coal for energy. It's making emissions-free energy using something else that can also break down coal for products. It's called a lifter.
For me, it's the most important project or most important subject in the world.
To explain, a lifter, spelled LFTR, is a liquid fluoride thorium reactor. Bit of a mouthful. It was a big contender to be the way the U.S. used nuclear power. Basically, it's a nuclear reactor that doesn't use uranium like most nuclear reactors, but instead mostly uses something called thorium. And a major difference between a lifter and a regular nuclear plant is that a lifter gets a lot hotter. And because of that heat, it could be used to break coal down into products which could be sold to keep the coal industry and coal communities afloat, in theory.
This represents the saving of the coal mining industry, and it is clean coal because no CO2 or emissions are produced in the process. So that is the only clean coal there is.
That's David Copeland. He's working with Earnshaw, who first read about lifters in The American Scientist in 2010.
And when I read the article, it just blew me away. I've never had anything like that affected me as greatly as this did. And so enlisted David Copeland, and the two of us have been working at it ever since.
We're both folk dancers, and we got together, and he said, Dave, you got to look at this. And so we've been plugging away.
And the two have been reaching out to state bodies and news organizations to promote lifters.
Talking it up.
But they aren't the only ones touting the technology. You can see TED Talks on it from Beirut, Copenhagen, CERN, and even Colorado. They're interested because it would have far less nuclear waste than our current reactors. Here's Kirk Sorensen, an engineer and nuclear technologist, talking at TEDx Colorado Springs.
To me, this is one of the great regrets, again, that this technology path was not chosen.
But no commercial-grade lifter has gotten off the ground. China announced plans to build one, but nothing has come of it yet. All these men have is a dream, some science, and a price tag. Here's Earnshaw.
We figure that it cost about $2 billion to get the lifter up and running to the point where you'd start making them in a factory. And that, compared to the amount we spend on energy now, is a relatively small sum. Now, I don't know, I don't have that in my hip pocket, but really, it wouldn't take a great deal of money if we could just find the right people to do it.
They've made little progress on lifters after years of work. So I asked them how much longer they can keep working on this. Earnshaw says,
well, I guess until I die or until I don't have the energy or the wit to continue any further.
Copeland added to that.
Yeah, and the outcome isn't up to us anyway. We just have to keep on trucking.
So we've explored clean coal's past and different kinds of clean coal, but what are the stakes? Well, about 30% of the energy in the United States and about 40% of the world's energy still comes from coal. And while U.S. coal use is on the decline, the world's coal use is not. So we're still pumping tons of CO2 in the air, so much so that scientists believe that even if we stopped doing that today, we'd still need to suck those carbon emissions directly from the air, not just at power plants. Now, we do know how to capture carbon from the air and from coal emissions, but the price for both is still too high. Way too high. And that's after coal companies alone have spent a decade working to clean that CO2 from their plants. And people and governments around the world have been working on carbon capture too, spending about $10 billion on it through capital investments. But according to the Global CCS Institute, which promotes the use of carbon capture to mitigate climate change, the world needs 2,000 carbon capture and storage facilities around the world by 2040 to avoid some of the worst consequences of climate change. And still, we only have 17 large CCS facilities around the world, and a swath of failed clean coal projects and projects too expensive to recreate without a lot of outside money. Now, President Donald Trump has touted clean coal going forward.
My administration is putting an end to the war on coal. Gonna have clean coal, really clean coal.
But he talks about it like our coal is already clean, that there's nothing we need to do to it except bring it back. But looking back at the several large-scale clean coal flops, it's hard to imagine how this is going to work. But Thompson of the Clean Air Task Force has an idea of how to do that. Incentivize carbon capture like we've incentivized renewables.
And so my hope is that these incentives that mirror a lot what renewables have received and currently receive in the United States will drive carbon capture over the next 15 years. To about the same levels that renewables are enjoying today in the energy system. And I think that's something that people on all sides of the ideological spectrum can find attractive.
There is some movement in Congress to further incentivize carbon capture through tax breaks. One such bill is the Future Act, which is sponsored by Democratic Senator Heidi Heitkamp of North Dakota and co-sponsored by 24 senators, including Wyoming's John Barrasso.
We had lunch this week with President Trump, and he talked about American energy.
That's Barrasso talking with me in October.
And, you know, he used to talk about energy security, and then we tried to talk about energy independence, but now the president is talking about energy dominance, and I think that's an important way to think about things.
Basically, he's a big fan of any technology that keeps coal around and that helps keep Wyoming's economy stable. Thompson pointed out that Republicans want to help fossil fuel industries thrive in their states, and Democrats want to mitigate climate change. So Congress could build momentum around this, theoretically. But it's failed in the past because each side has their favorite ways of moving forward. And still, Thompson is optimistic.
Even if it isn't, you know, at the moment, the favorite among, let's say, environmentalists or industry, I think its day is coming, and it's coming much sooner than people expect.
He says that with immediate help, carbon capture facilities could start going up nationwide in 3 to 5 years. He also acknowledges that solutions to climate change could take decades. But he'll keep working on it through carbon capture because
I feel we have the inherent advantage of being right.
So now my friend Dylan knows about clean coal, but he isn't convinced that it's such a great idea.
I don't want to have to send Matthew McConaughey into space in order to save humanity. The main thing I kind of took away, honestly, was Bill Nye. Just the thought that it might then it might be almost just a bit of a ruse in order to, again, protect the coal industry.
An industry that may be struggling, but is not going away anytime soon.
That was an Inside Energy special on clean coal. Please send questions about clean coal, coal emissions, or anything else energy related to ask@insideenergy.org. The answers may be in our next podcast. Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed individual segments or want to hear them again, you can go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Open Spaces. There you can listen to the entire show, sign up for our podcast, and pitch ideas for future programs. Anna Rader is our web editor. We always invite you to share our stories, and if you use the podcast, please rate it. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.